Okay, well, first of all, let me thank the organizers for inviting me. I really appreciate it. I'm going to be talking about the manganites and the related oxides. There's a lot of fundamentals of all these perovskite oxides, the cuprates, manganites, relaxer ferroelectrics have a lot of similarities. So here's the outline. So LBO ordered me to talk about CMR, so that's what I'm going to talk about. And I just wanted to mention a couple of different systems that I'm actually not going to talk about, but I thought I'd mention it in case somebody's interested later on. So with Chris Layton, we've been working on this lanthanum cobaltate. Both of these are phase-separated materials, and that's one of LBO's interests. And this is kind of a natural giant magnetoresistive material. And then with Peter Schiffer and his group, we've been looking at the avalanche behavior at low T, where you phase separate the system, and then, for example, you can just sit there on the edge of a precipice, and all of a sudden the system will spontaneously form a second state, and once it starts, it just goes to completion. It's kind of interesting. So you get these huge steps in the magnetization spontaneously. And then for the CMR systems, first of all, I want to talk about low doping, where you put a little bit of dopants in there and you get ferromagnetic droplets forming on either end of the phase diagram. And then in the colossal magnetoresistive regime, where the system's a ferromagnet, I'll show you a phase diagram, and I think probably last week you probably Sang Chong talked about this, did he? Okay, anyway, that's... in the ferromagnetic regime, that's where you get colossal magnetoresistance, and we'll see that there are lattice distortions that form that we affectionately call polarons, and they have a magnetic component as well. If these form in the ferromagnetic state, it actually truncates the ferromagnetic transition, makes it first order, and that enhances the GMR and makes it CMR, basically the idea. And then in the paramagnetic state, you actually have a glass phase that forms of these polarons. So you get, the way we see that with neutrons is you have a purely elastic component to the scattering in addition to the dynamics. And so you have this kind of glass phase, and I'll show you what I mean by that. And then the question is, what controls the formation of these polarons? And we've been looking at the effects of chemical disorder in this particular system, lanthanum, barium, manganese oxide, and we see when we randomize the system that that aids the formation of these polarons and truncates the ferromagnetic transition. Then I want to talk a little bit about the polaron dynamics in the system, so the inelastic scattering. And then we can break for lunch, and then I just want to mention kind of a what I call in quotes a polaron glass phase in the lightly doped yttrium barium copper oxide, and it's remarkable how much the scattering in this phase looks like the scattering in these manganites. So that's the kind of outline. I just wanted to mention some of the other systems that we're working on, in case somebody's interested. Besides the CMR systems, right now we're actually spending a lot of time working on multiferroics, homing manganese oxide, terbium manganese oxide, systems that are simultaneously magnetic and ferroelectric. Magnetic superconductors, Herb mentioned, he's also worked over the years on these magnetic superconductors, including the yttrium barium copper oxide, the cuprates, and magnetic ordering those systems, but also in the rare earth nickel boron carbides and some of these ruthenates. Heavy fermion materials with Wei Bao's group at Los Alamos and Brian Maple, for example. And most of these have come through, you know, collaborative efforts at our national facility. Non-Fermi liquids with Megan Aronson, some very recent work actually just last week, stopping on Thursday, and some previous work. And then with Peng Chen Dai's group on the scandium doping in the uranium palladium 3. Magnetic order and fluctuations in the electron doped superconductors, also with Peng Chen Dai's group and Herb Muck. Cobaltates, we've been working on the phase diagram of these, also looking at the phonons and the superconducting phase. Magnetic order at x equal half, kind of very interesting system there. And then frustrated magnets. We've been doing a lot of work at the NCNR on frustrated magnets. Okay, so I have a little bit of introductory material. So this is the perovskite structure. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, when you see pictures like this, you get an idea that this is a very open structure and you can do a lot of things. But in fact, this is a very tightly packed structure. If you actually put in the kind of the real size of the atoms, in fact, I had to make the oxygens a little bit smaller so you can even see the manganese back here. It's a very tight, compact structure, typically. And then the basic interactions, I'll go through this very quickly, is so you have d electrons, and the crystal field splits the T2G and EG levels, and you put three electrons in the T2G level, fully occupying it, and there's a very strong Hund's rule coupling, so the other T2G levels are out of the picture. And so that forms the kind of core spin. And then there's one extra electron from manganese 3 plus, there are four d electrons, and that one goes into this doubly degenerate EG level. And then you can split this degenerate level and lower the energy, and that's Jahn-Teller distortion. And so typically, rather than getting the pure cubic perovskite, you usually get some distorted ones where these octahedra are distorted. And you can have soft bonons associated with these, and it's kind of classic soft bonon behavior in some of these materials. And then the final thing is that if you have pure lanthanum manganese oxide, all the sites are occupied, it's an insulator, and it's actually anti-ferromagnetic insulator. If you want to dope it and get rid of some of these electrons, then this electron can hop over here. The only way it can do that is if the spins are parallel. Otherwise, it's going to be an insulator and, because of the strong Hund's rule coupling. So that basically, you know, couples the lattice, the spins, and the conductivity all together. And that's the kind of interesting thing. And as Takeshi already mentioned, you know, back in the good old days when we were young, you know, everybody avoided these systems like the plague, right? Because you didn't want to have the magnetic system coupled to the lattice. Lattice systems like soft bonons and structural phase transitions had long-range strain fields that changed the universality class. People wanted to look at the universality and the different parameters, and magnetic systems were the best. They weren't coupled to the lattice, and you could change the dimensionality, had very short range interactions, and that was what everybody did. And so these systems were just taboo, even though some of the very nice early work was done back in the 50s by Wally Kohler and Ernie Wollin. For the diffraction, neutron diffraction, they basically mapped out the entire phase diagram, and then Goodenough for his exchange selection rule. Okay, so here's the structure, lanthanum manganese oxide. And then you put in some calcium. So calcium is 2 plus, replaces the lanthanum 3 plus. So that takes manganese 3 plus and makes it manganese 4 plus. 4 plus means you lose that d electron. So that's how you dope the system. And then you get this phase diagram that a number of people have looked at, but this is one from Sang Chong. And so this is lanthanum manganese oxide, this is calcium manganese oxide, this is manganese 3 plus, this is manganese 4 plus. So here you have the Jahn-Teller distortion. Here, at the first approximation, you don't have any Jahn-Teller distortion. Manganese 4 plus, just a nice isotropic ion. And then you have this very rich phase diagram. And I'll show you, as you just poke your nose in here, you get these ferromagnetic droplets forming. You actually get ferromagnetic droplets forming if you come in from this side. And then most of the talk is going to be talking about this ferromagnetic phase. Right here is where you get this colossal magnetoresistance when you go through this phase boundary. And so we've been looking at up here is where you get the polaron formation. But first, let's look quickly at what happens when you lightly dope. This is actually our data, but it was first found by Martine Henyon and collaborators at Saclay. And basically you see this peak in the scattering, which tells you that there are ferromagnetic droplets forming in the system. And this is for like 5% calcium doping. And this is actually pretty robust scattering on the manganese 3 plus side, where you have this extra Eg electron.
So you've you can read off the size of the cross-section.
Yes. Well, yeah, actually, not actually from this data. What you actually get from this data is, first of all, you get the interparticle spacing, because this is actually a diffraction effect. The width will give you what the size of the particle is. And then you can actually do small angle scattering to look at the individual particles down here. So the scattering taking off is a different part of it. But this actually shows you the interparticle separation.
How does the homogeneous system look like? If you can draw it, is it
homogeneous? Yeah, you wouldn't have any scattering here.
But how do you make this? I mean, this is a theoretical question.
Well, I mean, this is just taking pure lanthanum manganese oxide and doping in 5% calcium.
Oh, it's calcium, but no thermogenic droplets. It's like paramagnet, I guess.
Well, the overall system's antiferromagnetic insulator. But in addition to that antiferromagnetic insulator, you see these clusters form that are ferromagnetic.
If I was to subtract clusters,
then you wouldn't see the scattering, right? You would just. Well, yes. I mean, so there are Bragg peaks out, you know, way out, right?
So this is actually the fact that it's such a small cube.
Right. This is a small cube, right?
Large pieces kind of warps, you start sampling.
Right. Yeah. So these have the size of about 10 angstroms. That's kind of a scale. A nanometer is kind of a scale that comes in throughout. So, you know, so this is inhomogeneous in that sense, right? So. Yeah.
Probably related to Sasha's question. This Q, you said, relates to the size of the particle?
No, the Q relates to the interparticle spacing. Yeah, so that's, it's actually easier to see that. So if you were to do a small angle neutron scattering experiment with energy analysis, actually, because you have to separate out the elastic from inelastic, then there's another component that comes up here. So if you had just isolated clusters, then you would see scattering that would peak at Q equals zero, and this is the absolute value of Q, and then would just come down, and that distribution would give you the size of the cluster. And that's a standard technique, whether you're looking at, ferromagnetic system or a radius of gyration for some biological molecule or polymer or whatever. The small angle scattering technique tells you, what the size of things are. This was actually taken on triple axis spectrometer in order to get energy resolution so that we can separate out the elastic from inelastic scattering. That makes the measurement a lot easier. When you do that, you really can't push into as small a Q as you can on a SANS instrument. So this is actually, this peak is kind of a liquid structure factor peak.
Okay. So size could be larger. Height cannot be small and larger than.
Absolutely, that's so right.
This is a photo of the lower.
Right, yeah, that's so right, yeah. So, I mean, it's just but it's an interference effect.
Right.
It's not just
because
a single particle.
This is sort of goes down like a 0.2 or 0.3.
Right, yeah. Now, let me show you the other on coming in. So this is coming in from this side. If we look at it from this side, yeah.
Does it actually scale the rate? Does it scale with doping?
Yes. Yeah. So that so the parameters you get out for the strength of the scattering. This is the other side, which is 9% lanthanum doping on calcium manganese oxide. So in this case, you're starting out with manganese that are more or less undistorted, and then when you put in the calcium, the lanthanum, then you get some Eg electrons which can distort. And so again, if we could push down the smaller Q, the scattering should go up, but we actually can't see that with this. But this is just kind of a liquid structure factor calculation where we've actually gotten the cluster concentration out, and the cluster concentration and the distribution, are in agreement. Where you see the peak position shows you how many clusters you have in that.
Can you tell whether those clusters are moving or they are static?
Well, this is elastic scattering. So, and the energy resolution is probably maybe half a millivolt or so in this particular case. So on that scale, they're static. But there may be a dynamic component to them. And in fact, even at 2% lanthanum, you can see the scattering here. It's a lot weaker, as you can see, but then this is just a kind of a liquid structure factor calculation. And that also, the parameters you get out of that for the peak position and make sense. So that's basically what happens when you first dope the system from either end. And then what I'd like to do is to concentrate now on this ferromagnetic regime. And just to show you some magnetoresistance data, so I mean, it's a reasonably good metal at low temperatures. And then when you go through the phase transition, you see this jump in the resistivity, and you have this kind of hopping conductivity. And you can suppress that with a magnetic field. So that's the magnetoresistive effect, and people plot it like this. Historically, it's actually kind of interesting because, you know, most materials don't have any significant magnetoresistance. And then there are a few materials like permalloy that have like a 1% effect. And then when giant magnetoresistance came along, it was the order of 10% effect. And then if you wanted to brag, you wanted to try to divide here by the smallest number you could find. So they would always, instead of dividing by the resistance in zero field, they would divide by the resistance at large field, where, you know, and get it up to 11%, you know, and then they could brag, you know, mine's 11%. And then when CMR came along, then they started dividing by, you know, really small numbers. And so people, the early papers, they started quoting, you know, it was 100% and 1,000% and 10^6%. And that's, and then finally people settled down. Actually, the biggest colossal magnetoresistive material is europium moly sulfide, which is a system that is antiferromagnetic. And then when you apply a field, it goes superconducting, and then you can divide by zero. So that's anyway. So here in this system, in this regime, it's a reasonably good metal, and then you go into this paramagnetic phase, and in addition, right in here, so it's a very good isotropic ferromagnet. So it's kind of interesting, as soon as you get into this metallic regime, the spin waves are isotropic. I mean, it's all the way through this regime. So that, I mean, it's as isotropic as some of the Met glass systems that have been observed. So it's that means that there's basically, for neutron scattering, there's no gap in the system, as you can see. And that's, and then you go from an isotropic ferromagnet to a paramagnetic, you know, hopping conductivity system there.
So this is isotropic because the underlying lattice is already isotropic or fairly isotropic, or because of this cluster, they do the averaging sort of like?
Well, I think the clusters merge by the time you get into the pure ferromagnetic regime. And as soon as you get there, it turns out that it's really a band magnet. So it's a metallic magnet where the exchange is really double exchange that comes through this, it's permeated by this EG electron.
The band magnet itself is, if I were to do very simple speed wave analysis, I would get isotropic effect.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and so, I mean, you know, so this is just a simple Heisenberg model just to let you know how we actually do these measurements. So, down here for a ferromagnet, it's just a parabola. There may be a gap in the system, but in our case, you know, there is no significant gap. So you just get the spin stiffness, which is in mean field just the magnetization, but it's a temperature dependent quantity times Q squared. So in the early days, we studied powder materials because that was all that was available to study. And so that requires, the only spin waves we can actually measure with neutron scattering is down at small q. So we did all of our measurements early on down in this small q regime. So right here, and if you're not familiar with neutron scattering, you just scan here, you pick a q here, and you do a scan. Here's energy transfer zero, And then you can go in and create spin waves in the system where the neutron loses energy, energy loss, or destroy spin waves and have energy gain. So this is one particular Q. And then you can do that in a series of Qs and a series of temperatures and map out the spin wave stiffness as a function of temperature. And, you know, in the usual theory, this is just, power law behavior and crashes in at the transition temperature. So this is a lanthanum and barium system that's not anomalous. So I just show you, and basically everything follows down. You can actually push in here even further if you want, but I mean, this is actually goes down pretty far. And the reason I wanted to show you that is when we went to this CMR material, lanthanum calcium manganese oxide, then everything looks fine. The spin waves are renormalizing, and it looks like TC should be above 300 Kelvin, and all of a sudden you hit TC. So the D versus temperature looks discontinuous.
What is the magnetization nucleus?
I'll show you. That's, So that's it's coming up.
Okay.
Yeah. So for the inelastic scattering, you see, so these are three different temperatures at this same wave vector, just to show you basically what's going on. And you see from 200 Kelvin to 225, the spin waves have softened. They've actually broadened a bit. But it's interesting, you notice that the intensity has decreased here, not increased. And it should follow the Bose thermal population factor, but it hasn't. And instead, you get this central component to the fluctuation spectrum. And for isotropic ferromagnets, that's a whole different story, but that's not been seen in isotropic ferromagnets. So there are what we call ZZ fluctuations, but typically they're buried down in here, and you need polarized neutrons in order to sort that out. But so this was kind of unusual, and the D versus temperature was kind of unusual. And if you just plot this central peak, it comes up, peaks around TC, and then comes down. This is our very first powder diffraction data. And then interestingly, the spin wave intensity, starts to come up. And as soon as this central peak starts to come in, you start losing intensity here, rather than actually, having the spin wave intensity itself go up. So that really, our interpretation was this was a kind of two-phase coexistence, where you have a discontinuous transition in the system. And since then, we've done a lot of different work, and this is the magnetization versus temperature, actually the square of the magnetization. So neutrons measure the zero field magnetization. That's one nice thing you can get out of that. And so we have, obviously, data all the way down to low temperatures. But then when you get up around this transition temperature, two things that you see. First of all, you see kind of a, kind of a drop-off. In the early powder data, things were smeared enough that, you didn't see anything really obvious. But you did see this kind of hysteresis. It's not true hysteresis, but irreversibility on warming and cooling. And this irreversibility is actually just the impatience of the investigator, because it turns out that if you, for example, cool down to here, that if you wait long enough, it'll actually, the intensity will come up here. And so this shows you on a single crystal, you got a lot of intensity. You can actually monitor it as a function of time. So this is an intensity versus time. You can watch this come up. And eventually these two curves coming from warming and cooling will merge. So there is no true hysteresis that we can observe. But you see this kind of long time scale dependence in the system. So which also is an indication that it's first order in nature. So this is kind of the time constant that we got out of those measurements of the Bragg peak intensity. We've also done small angle neutron scattering measurements where you see these irreversibilities as well. And you see that this time scale kind of peaks up right at TC, where this D of versus temperature is kind of discontinuous. And then there's one nice trick you can play, which is to actually do oxygen isotope dependent studies. So you can change oxygen 16 for oxygen 18, and that actually changes TC here. And then we can follow the spin dynamics. Here's over a broader scale, but look in here. And basically what happens is that the system is truncated at a different temperature, depending on whether it's oxygen 16 or oxygen 18, and that tells you immediately that the lattice is involved in the system. And there's no significant change in the spin dynamics here. You just change where you are on this curve, and this is chosen here to be right at the maximum, which is x equal 3/8, so that any, if you worry about any oxygen changes in the overall oxygen concentration, shouldn't have any effect. But this isotope dependence of the transition temperature was found by magnetization measurements, and down in here it actually can be quite large, 20 or 30 Kelvin, and it was controversial for quite some time. And we chose to study it right in here, both because that you're right at the top, and so you don't have to worry about overall oxygen concentration, which we can measure by neutron powder diffraction. But also, you're very close to the actual transition that would occur if you didn't have any interruption. And so you actually get a significant change in where this D versus temperature comes, because you're going kind of on the steep portion of this curve. So it's just fortuitous that we're in a regime where you actually get a pretty big change in D, and you can, you know, with the oxygen 16, you can follow this up quite a bit, significantly higher temperatures and softer Ds compared to the oxygen 18, which gets truncated here. And those truncations are determined by the Bragg peak in the same experiment. Okay, now I mentioned that there's coupling to the lattice, so we ought to be able to see the lattice coupling. Everything I've been talking about so far is all magnetic scattering in the system. And sure enough, there are nanoscale correlations in these that are associated with the structure of the system. This is a Bragg peak here, and then at these quarter-quarter positions, which is known as a CE-type structure, you get these peaks in the scattering. And these are four Brillouin zones. Okay, so this is mapping out, and these are quite broad, corresponding to a size of about, again, 1 nanometer. And in addition, there's also diffuse scattering around the Bragg peak. And so we'll get to some of the details of that a little later on. So I want to look at this scattering here. Yep?
This is another four Brillouin zone, but you said it's quarter?
No, this is four Brillouin zones, basically. I mean, this is one zone from 0 to 1/2. Yeah, so this is just showing the symmetry of the scattering. So you get these kind of quarter-quarter peaks around each fundamental Bragg peak.
There is no 0, 0.
Well, I mean, 0, 0 is the Bragg peak here. So this is the 060 Bragg peak, and then there are these four positions around here. I think it's here is one Brillouin zone, yeah. No, we actually measured it because we wanted to see how this, and you know, not all the intensities. So if you can measure enough of these, then you can actually, you know, it's like the fraction, you can do the structure. So we've measured, you know, maybe 15 or 20 of these all together, but we wanted to measure, and it makes a nice picture, right?
What is the size of this kind of director from the point, from gamma point, from center to the bright?
The half position? Yeah. Right. So let me just show you what the data looks like just cutting through here. So this is what those peaks actually look like if you look at the, you know, a cut through there. The width of this is way bigger than our instrumental resolution, and corresponds to about 10 or 12 angstroms in real space. And well, I wouldn't call them ferromagnetic. I mean, these are no. So these are structural peaks, okay, associated with the lattice distortion in the system. So the previous stuff that I showed you, well, the spin waves, let's see. Yeah, the spin waves would come out of here. other thing. But, you know, if you want to look at the spin waves, then out at these large reciprocal lattice points, the spin wave intensity is pretty small. There's a magnetic form factor, yeah.
This is elastic?
This is elastic, and I'll get to that. I'll show you the inelastic as well. So that's, so this is purely elastic scattering, showing you that this scattering is broad, and this length scale of 1 nanometer, 10 angstroms, comes up repeatedly. If you look at the magnetic kind of critical scattering, then the scattering looks like a Lorentzian, which is classic, but the correlation length you get out is 10, 12 angstroms, and weakly temperature dependent. That's another clue. I didn't go into that, but I mean, that's another clue that you don't have a conventional second order transition because you don't see any divergences in the usual way because of this polaron formation. So this was, so we did this, and then back before we were friends, we were competitors with Peng Chen Dai and Jaime Fernandez Baca. And then they shut down Heifer and we became friends. and started collaborating.
Why are you calling it polaron
peaks? Oh, okay. Yeah, strictly speaking, polarons, one electron getting trapped by lattice. And so that was the idea here. And so when we saw these peaks, you know, that's what we call them. So this is, but I don't mean to imply that ideal picture of one electron being trapped, that corresponds to these polarons. And I'll get into that a little bit more. Actually, length scale is a little bit too big for that, I think, 10 angstroms. And in addition, these are correlations, not single polarons. And so I'll show you the single polaron scattering as well. But so I would call, so we call them polarons because we think that's basically what's happening.
But it's a better lattice distortion.
But this is a lattice distortion, yeah. And of course, neutrons.
In order to be polaron, you have to like say something about what charges.
Right. Yeah, and I'll show you that in a minute. Yeah.
Can you tell us the significance of 1/4?
One-fourth
position of the peak.
No, I'm not going to tell you that. No, that's. So these peaks come because of the correlations between these lattice distortions. Okay, so at half doping, this CE structure is an orbitally in charge ordered system, and that structure quadruples the unit cell and gives peaks at a quarter-quarter. And since we see peaks at a quarter-quarter, then we call that a CE-type lattice distortion. And there's antiferromagnetic peaks that are associated with a CE structure that we do not see.
Sir, how would you distinguish polaron from a charge density wave that has some kind of checkerboard structure and therefore it has some kind of polar?
Well, I mean, let me show you the resistivity data. And that's... we can't distinguish that. And so, I mean, I would say that, you know, I just call these polarons because we need a name. You know, we could call those Elbios if you wanted. Yeah, but Elbio didn't want to have this. Yeah. At the time we went to polarons, Elbio said, no, don't call them after me. You know, I don't know if I believe them. So that's, but we need a name for them, so we just call them polarons. Actually, the first Fizrev letter I wrote on this thing, I put in polarons, and referee said, oh, you can't call them polarons. And so I just, you know, we didn't call them polarons. And then later on people said, well, you didn't call them polarons, you know. You should have called them polarons. So maybe this answers some of your questions about what's going on here. So we also call these charge peaks. Okay, so that's, maybe talk a little bit about that. So here's the intensity. So, you know, below TC in a high-quality crystal, you don't see any scattering here, and then the scattering pops up as you go through the ferromagnetic transition. And this quasi-elastic magnetic peak, here's the intensity of that on the same single crystal. And then a dashed line is the resistivity, okay? So this is right where the resistivity is going through this phase transition from metallic behavior to hopping conductivity. So our idea, I mean the mental picture here is that The electrons are these EG electrons are the ones that are carrying the exchange information and the conductivity. And then as the electron is sitting there, as you approach the paramagnetic state, you know, the spins on neighboring sites are down as, you know, almost as much as they are up. And so it gets harder and harder to hop across that site. And so the electron's got to wait until it finds one of its neighbors that's, you know, up, and then it can hop across there. If it waits too long, the lattice has enough time to distort, and then the electron gets trapped. So that's the kind of mental picture of what's going on here. So then we would use this plot to claim that, you know, that these all these effects are correlated. You know, the resistivity, these quarter-quarter peaks, and the quasi-elastic contribution to the scattering, which is just paramagnetic scattering in this two-phase behavior, they all follow the same, you know, they all have the same origin. And I just mentioned that if you look in the paramagnetic state and apply a magnetic field, then you can suppress these quarter-quarter peaks. Okay, so that's this is the resistivity. So this is the CMR effect. So these correlated peaks are directly associated with a CMR effect. And another interesting thing is we applied uniaxial stress. Pressure doesn't, you know, uniform pressure doesn't seem to do much at all. But uniaxial stress actually enhances the scattering quite dramatically. This CMR effect was actually discovered on thin films. I mean, you know, the CMR effects were known previously, but they weren't nearly as big. When you put them on thin films, and they got these enormous changes in the resistivity, and that's really what got the ball rolling in terms of interest and of course in terms of applications. So people got really interested in these things. So strain has a big effect on these polaron peaks. Okay, so I just want to mention that the scattering pops up above the Curie temperature, and then there's a question about what we call single polaron or isolated polarons versus these correlated peaks. But these correlated peaks are real peaks in the system, so they come through correlations with the other peaks. And so here's this picture again. So these are these correlation peaks, and then there's this diffuse scattering around the Bragg peak. And they have actually quite different temperature dependencies. So this is the scattering around the Bragg peak. It's zero, and this is with good energy resolution until you get up to the TC, and then it kind of pops up, and it's just more or less flat. So this is what we would call a single polaron, isolated polaron. They form as you go through the phase transition, and truncate the ferromagnetic transition, and it's more or less temperature independent. So this is basically the scattering right in here, okay, you know, well away from where these peaks come.
And why is this telling something with the single?
Well, because, this is the diffuse scattering. So when you have lattice defects that have no significant correlations in the system, typically that scattering kind of peaks up around the Bragg peaks, the fundamental Bragg peaks. So and we see that scattering come in, and we can see it with X-rays as well, right? That scattering doesn't have any strong Q dependence to it like this, where you see a clear peak. Okay, so, and it has a different temperature dependence, as I was just showing you here.
So this is what you would expect in an ordinary polaron.
Right, yeah. That's right, yeah, isolated polarons, that's right, yeah.
But here we have 30% doping.
Right, so yeah, but this is very heavily doped, yeah, absolutely, yeah, very heavily doped, yeah, yep. So this is what we call the correlated polarons. And they really do have quite different temperature dependencies. In fact, we've been studying that in more detail.
Except for the transport, I haven't seen a sharp statement why I should call their polarons.
Yeah.
It's a lattice distortion, beautiful.
Right, yeah. And also there's a magnetic component to that lattice distortion as well that we can see. Right.
Another argument that supports the
supports your terminology.
No. No, just the resistivity, just the fact that you're going through, you know, a metal insulator type transition. I think that's the only reason to call it bolt-on.
Well, I'm just learning, so.
Yes, no, it's fine, yeah.
If you put this brilliant on the picture of the peaks, what happens is I change the doping.
Okay.
It's taken to be made about a quarter, how.
Yeah, I think maybe Valerie will talk a little bit about that. Yeah. I mean, the peaks don't actually come right at quarter-quarter, and there is some doping dependence to that. Yeah, and Valerie has some.
They do respond to the charges, and that's what.
Yes.
Yeah, right. The yeah. Dependence on the
right. Yeah.
Position of the peak.
Yeah. Position. Yeah. Right. Over. You know. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. So I just wanted to summarize a little bit here before we move on to dynamics. So the CMR. This, when these polarons form, it seems to truncate the ferromagnetic transition. So, and there are systems where the ferromagnetic transition is not truncated, and then you get a classic second order phase transition. The correlation, magnetic correlation length diverges, and things like that. But in this lanthanum calcium in the CMR systems, you get this truncation drives the system first order. And that makes it much more sensitive to perturbations like applied magnetic fields. And one other thing I wanted to mention was that the intensity of these polaron peaks, you saw the field dependence or temperature dependence. Basically, when you create ferromagnetism in the sample, either by lowering the temperature or applying a magnetic field, it has the same effect on the polaron intensity, and it just drops and basically just scales with that magnetization. Excuse me?
Because you already showed the oxygen substituting like oxygen item effect.
Right.
Oxygen, whatever, oxygen.
You mean the position of the peaks? Yeah, we don't know that. And you can grow crystals up to about 30%. Beyond 30%, you can't grow single crystals. In order to see the lattice scattering, you really need single crystals. So that was doping of x equal 3/8, which is right at the maximum TC, and there you can't grow single crystals. So we don't know what the peaks are doing. Yes. Right. Yeah, and there are some strong phonon anomalies, and I don't know if Peng Chen's going to talk about that. Do you know what Peng Chen's going to talk about? Because the Oak Ridge group's been studying the phonons. Okay. All right. So there are some anomalies in the phonons. Yeah, well, we have looked actually pretty hard to see if there's a conventional soft phonon like a second order phase transition, and I haven't been able to really see that. You see some damping effects, and then we see the kind of polaron effects, which I'm going to show you in a little while at the quarter-quarter position, we see the dynamics of the system, right? So that and that's lattice scattering. But it doesn't look like a phonon, right? So it looks more like a central peak. So polaron formation truncates the transition. The spin wave stiffness is discontinuous. Then you have this two-phase coexistence, ferromagnetic metal versus a paramagnetic insulator, Hopping conductivity. And then you get these long relaxation effects around TC. And then the kind of what we call a single polaron scattering is just this diffuse structural scattering just pops up at the transition temperature. And then these correlated peaks that have a very strong temperature dependence, they also pop up at the transition temperature and then die away. And the quasi-elastic paramagnetic scattering, the strength of that scattering just pops up. And that's just a measure, really, of these two different phases, okay? So, in those pictures I showed you a central peak and then spin waves. The spin waves are the ferromagnetic metal. The central quasi-elastic peak is the paramagnetic insulator. Okay, so here are these Polaron Mountains, and we made them in the mountains now. So that's just a nice picture. That's why we measured four of them. We got the, and then the question is, what's controlling this Polaron picture? Okay, so recently we've been looking at the lanthanum and barium system, right around x equal half doping. Not exactly at x equal half, because at x equal half you get some additional structures coming in. So here's the chemically disordered. This is the perovskite structure, and this is the lanthanum and calcium or barium site, and this is just randomly occupied. But then by proper heat treatment, you can actually order the system so that you have lanthanum and barium sites ordered in an A-type, what we call A-type, so you just get layers along one of the axes. And so you can look at this chemically ordered system, or you can look at the chemically disordered system, which is actually the same sample, just heat treated differently. And then if you look at the magnetic order parameter, and so now all of these measurements are on polycrystalline materials, because again, in this system, there are no single crystals available. And here's the magnetic scattering with a phase transition about 350 Kelvin. And for a powder, this is a nice sharp transition. It's about as sharp as you're ever going to see on a powder. And so that's what that looks like. And then for the chemically disordered system, you actually get a nice sharp transition as well, but at 300 Kelvin. So you see a very large change in TC. And the question is, what's causing that change? And there are actually two things that are causing that. The interesting thing is you in the disordered system, you get this long time scale behavior here, right around the transition. So you get this irreversibility in the system. If you wait long enough, you get exactly the same order parameter on warming and cooling within experimental error. But you've got to wait, probably 20 minutes for the system to come into full equilibrium, whereas over in here, it equilibrates in, a minute and a half, 2 minutes, something like that. So this is an indication there's a little bit of irreversibility when we actually measured this. If you measure wait long enough due to the time dependence, you see this long time scale behavior in the disordered system, but not in the ordered system. And so that's the first hint that what's happening here is what we think is happening is that when you disorder the system, you're forming polarons, and at least part of the suppression of 50 Kelvin is due to this truncation of the ferromagnetic transition. There's the time dependence. There is some change in the exchange, okay, and so that's very important. The data I showed you on the isotope substitution, we saw no change in the D, but here we see about 8% change in the spin wave stiffness parameter, so the disorder system is lower, but not nearly enough to explain that 50 Kelvin transition. Okay. So here are some spin waves, and you see this in the disordered system, you get this central component to the fluctuation spectrum coming in. Much harder data to take than the previous one, than the lanthanum calcium. But when we analyze that, what we find is that in the ordered system, you get spin waves that come up, and basically at TC, you lose the spin waves, and all the strength of the scattering is in the paramagnetic scattering. But in the disordered system, you see this central component come in, and as that comes in, you get the loss of intensity in the spin wave. So it looks just like the lanthanum calcium. Now, of course, we're not able to do single crystals where we can look at the polaron structural scattering directly. But our interpretation is that when you chemically disorder the system, that enhances the polaron formation, and you get this truncation in the system. So that's our interpretation. And I just point out, some critics have said, maybe it's just a smearing of the transition, but you can see that this transition certainly isn't smeared in any sense. In fact, it may be, if anything, a little bit sharper than in the ordered system. And you certainly can't explain it by a TC that's spread out by 25 or 50 Kelvin. That's clearly inappropriate. Okay, now what about the dynamics of the pole arm?
You have the resistivities for the two cases. That I think it's really dramatic. But in one case, you have the CMR, and in the other,
yes.
You don't.
No, I don't have. Yeah, now the powder is hard to do resistivity. So. No, I don't have those. Well, who?
The
Dobrin? Yeah. Does he? Yeah, that's a little bit different system. Yeah, so that's. Yeah. Well, sorry. It's not as nearly as big as the calcium. That's absolutely correct. Yeah. And okay, so what about the dynamics? We already had that question. So I'll show you some X-ray diffuse scattering taken at the APS. And so this is the fundamental bright peak. It's a little hard to see here. And here's this quarter peak. But this is orthorhombic notation, so it's not cubic notation, but that's the same peak. And you can do scans through here and scans through here, and I'll show you what those actually look like. So here's a scan just across the peak. You get a nice peak here. Here's a scan from the bright peak. This is what we would call the single polaron. And then you have this correlation peak, and you can follow the temperature dependence of that scattering. And so here's what you get for this lanthanum calcium manganese oxide. This is the polaron scattering. And of course, X-rays energy integrate. So this is all the scattering in the system. And here's this kind of single polaron scattering. Okay. And you see you get this nice enhancement of the scattering, and then it kind of collapses down. By the time you get up to a little bit above 400, then the two components are gone, are the same, and basically this peak in the scattering is gone. So all you have is kind of the single polaron scattering. And then we can do with neutrons, we can do the energy dependence of the scattering. Okay, and in fact, this is a nice example of the complementarity of X-rays and neutrons. And then the interesting thing is you get this purely elastic peak within our resolution, and then this quasi-elastic scattering. And this is at 260 Kelvin. And so this is this purely elastic peak. And you can actually take that peak and just map it right onto this polaron scattering. So that's just looking at the elastic contribution. It says that the dominant contribution to this peak here is purely elastic in the system. And then they come together up here around 400 or so. And so that's a transition, and so we'll call that T star. That's the. Now, of course, high TC people aren't very happy with stealing their T star, so we'll call it T dollar. So we don't. Otherwise, we won't be able to get it published, right? And say, hey, what are you doing? But so the interesting thing is we have some nice data that Jaime's still working on writing up that. Of these peaks, I mean, basically all the interesting physics associated with the resistivity and stuff is associated with these correlation peaks, not with the kind of single polaron things. And I think maybe Valerie's going to talk a little bit more about that. But these correlation peaks, you can see they're quite temperature dependent, but their width doesn't change very much. I mean, a little bit, but not very much. So these peaks just kind of pop up, and then they just kind of come down. And by the time you get up to higher temperatures, the scattering is more or less flat. So one of the criterion we can say is that, you know, once we get to a regime where the scattering is more or less, you know, featureless, then we're at T star. You know, we've lost these correlations in the system, and that makes it a little bit easier to measure rather than doing a full, you know, measurement of the dynamics and statics and trying to sort it out that way. You can just look at these strength of these correlation peaks with either X-rays or neutrons and come up with an idea of kind of where these correlations first form. So that's our T star. Okay, so that's so right here then we have this ferromagnetic isotropic ferromagnetic metallic regime, and then we go into this regime up here where we have short range order, in space, so that 1 nanometer length scale, and but a purely elastic component to the scattering. So that's like a glass. Okay, so that's why we call that a polaron glass. And then the question is, what happens above here? Then the scattering becomes purely dynamic. So there's no more elastic contribution. This is work with the, on this bilayer manganite, but the physics is the same. So you can kind of scan across this at a finite energy, and you see that you still have these correlations in the system, these structural correlations, but it's purely dynamic. There's no static component anymore. And the static component goes with this kind of correlation peak that we see in the structure.
So basically, I still see quite a weight piling up with low energies. So
yes, yeah, and that's just the thermal factor, right? Yeah, so if you remember, well, I'll show you in a minute, but remember there's a purely elastic component and then there's the quasi-elastic. So at around 400, the elastic component has come down and it's all inelastic. But it still peaks at equals zero, so it's still quasi-elastic. Okay. And then the last part of this, let me just show you. So this is the data I showed you before for the lanthanum calcium manganese oxide. And you have this quasi-elastic scattering here. One of the interesting things is there's been some very recent work on lightly doped yttrium barium copper oxide. This is has a TC of 18 Kelvin. And this is spin dynamics. This is our lattice dynamics here, the structural scattering. But you see the similarities here. They see this elastic or quasi-elastic component for the scattering, and then this additional inelastic scattering that they interpret as a kind of looking like a soft phonon type of central peak coming in, but magnetic in the system. That looks a lot like the polaron scattering. And in fact, I didn't suggest even the coloring scheme, but you can see that the scattering looks almost identical in these two. So that's, yeah. You have a question? Just ignore her. Okay. So I was actually quite excited about this. This is Chris Stock and collaborators, and Chris is actually at our place now. And the data were actually taken at Chalk River. And so that really looks very interesting. There are a lot of similarities between the manganites and cuprates in these systems. And with these kind of inhomogeneities, these intrinsic inhomogeneities. Okay, so the summary is the manganites, spin charge and lattice are all coupled. These are highly correlated electron systems with competing states that have a very delicate energetic balance. In the CMR regime, we go from ferromagnetic metal to polaron glass and then a polaron liquid. A lot of similarities between this system and relaxer ferroelectrics. In relaxer ferroelectrics, the idea is you have these nanoscale, 10 angstrom domains that are ferroelectric, and they're just dying to get in the action. Put a little bit of electric field and you get this giant response. And it's the same thing with the CMR materials. You know, I mean, you have these kind of ferromagnetic clusters or polarons that are just dying to be, truly ferromagnetic. You apply a little magnetic field and boom, they go. One of the fundamental questions is, why don't they go on their own? What's holding them back? Why don't they, if they're that sensitive and that eager to be ferromagnetic or ferroelectric, why don't they just do it? Anyway, and then of course there are a lot of similarities with stripes and cuprates and nickelates. So. And then finally, I just wanted to mention I have a lot of interesting collaborators. I just listed the ones that I think I talked about. I tried to put all the references up there too. I just some from Nis Taku Sato and Eduardo Granado, Matt Woodward and Carl Adams were all postdocs. The lanthanum barium was Bogdan Dabrowski, William Radcliffe. And Valerie, we worked with Sang-Wook Chong on the isotope dependence of the system, and Valerie's going to talk about his work. Vera Smolyaninova from University of Maryland. Now some of these people, of course, moved off. But, she's no longer there. Rick Green, Jakub Makovsky has grown a lot of these crystals. In fact, he's grown the best lanthanum calcium manganese oxide crystals. And then there's a whole parade of people from Argonne on the bilayer manganites and on these avalanche materials, in particular Dmitry Argyriou, who's now at the Hahn-Meitner Institute, John Neumeier for this lightly doped system, and then the Oak Ridge crowd, Jaime Fernandez-Baca, Peng Chen Dai, and recently Feng Yi. I didn't actually talk about that work. I thought maybe Peng Chen would, and then the group through Peng Chen with Yosha Takuri's group. So anyway, I hope I got everybody. So thanks very much for your attention.
I'm just wondering about the relation between this droplet picture and the polar arm thing, so what's the event picture? So knowing the size and the concentration of those so-called polar arm things, can you figure out how many electrons are actually sitting in them?
From the droplets, yes. Well, we can't figure out how many electrons, because we, you know, I mean, neutrons and X-rays too, I mean, they don't really measure charge. Right. Number of droplets, yeah, we have that information. Oops, yeah. Yeah, if you noticed on those slides, well, maybe, yeah. Yeah, we have maybe three or four different concentrations that we've done those on the electron dope side, starting from calcium manganese oxide. And we have all the fitted parameters for the number of droplets and the size of the droplets. But we don't know how much charge. I mean, you can guess, that, you know, if you put one lanthanum in, that produces one charge. But that's a dangerous guess. I mean, if you look at X equal half, for example, then the folk lure is the CE structure is that half the manganese are 3+ and half the manganese are 4+. But that's an idealized picture, and we know that the charge disproportionation is more like 3.4 and 3.6, not 4 and 3. So, you know, just doing simple counting can be, you know, I mean, you can try that, but, you know.
So when you call them polarons, you don't necessarily mean that it is a single electron, which is...
No, that's only theorists believe that. Well, I mean, some theorists get hyperactive about that, but I mean, that's kind of an ideal picture, is one electron produces one polaron, and this is typically a heavily concentrated system, and there certainly could be more than one electron in there. It's just a name that started and it's now stuck. So that's what people call them. They call these the polaron peaks. For a while, they were called charge peaks, and people said, well, you know, you don't know they're charge peaks. So. So, please don't get hung up on that, because, I mean, it really is just the name, you know, that's started. Right. I mean, there's an important physics question, but we can't, you know, certainly neutron scattering can't answer that.
I think I have a physics question, but I don't know, maybe turn out humanity.
Yeah, okay.
It's about IBC.
Uh-huh.
And the one you showed.
Yeah, at the end? Yeah. Yeah, this guy.
So, is this extreme polarized neutron scattering?
Yes. Yeah, so this is...
extreme under doped.
This is extreme under doped, right. It's like 6% away from the superconducting phase boundary. TC is 18 Kelvin.
Yeah, but no, there is this training thing about the extreme glass, or whatever, people talk about cluster glass.
Right.
So why this is kind of like...
So their claim, the one claim is that, these are spin fluctuations, and the second thing is that there is no anti-ferromagnetic long-range order in this sample. And so this is what the spin fluctuation spectrum looks like, and its temperature dependence is matched to TC.
Right.
I didn't show you that, but, yeah.
So my question
yes.
is, why I should be worried about polarons when you show this one, because we know that there is plenty of evidence for spin glass going on there.
Right.
Yeah, the main subject of your talk was about polarons.
Right. No, I did, yeah. Well, I mean, I just wanted to point out the similarity in the nature of the dynamics. Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And I wanted to mention that, I mean, these lattice peaks that we see, the structural peaks, in this lanthanum calcium system, very difficult to see any magnetic contribution. But in other systems, we, you know, there is a magnetic contribution to those lattice peaks as well. It turns out that in the lanthanum calcium, the magnetic correlation range is so short, and the polaron peak itself is short range. And by the time you try to take that polaron peak and dress it with something that's a 10 angstrom correlation length in addition, the signal just blocked out. But in other systems that we've studied, actually with the Oak Ridge group, you can see both the magnetic contribution and the lattice contribution. So you need the correlation range to be substantially longer. So there is a magnetic contribution, but my only point here is to show the similarity between the spin dynamics in the high TC system, at least at this doping, and this structural scattering, polaron scattering that we see in the manganite.
We have three curves that track each other.
Yes.
The quarter-quarter
right.
Magnetic distortion
right.
and
quasi-elastic. Right, right.
You didn't actually tell us why you think that's, or maybe I missed it, why the central peak is also tracking everything.
Oh, it's just because the system is a two-phase system. So you have the yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So basically, what happens at low temperatures, you have this nice ferromagnetic metal, and then you start getting, it's a first-order transition. You start getting regimes where the system converts into the paramagnetic insulator. When that happens, the paramagnetic intensity goes up, because it's paramagnetic, and the polaron scattering goes up at the same time. And so they go together. So those
just cause diffuse scattering around the central region.
Right, exactly.
Is this what is called the central peak in the more broader sense?
No. The central peak, when people talk about central peaks in structural phase change and soft phonon, so that has a long history. And so what happens in ferroelectric systems, back in the 60s and 70s, they had the, you know, when they first started studying soft phonons, and you have this soft phonon that comes down and, you know, and touches the axis, and you get a Bragg peak there. And then there were particularly ferroelectric systems that where the phonon would start to soften, but it never went to zero, and instead you'd get a central component to the fluctuation spectrum that was elastic. And sometimes quasi-elastic, most of the time purely elastic. Sometimes in a system like KDP, they actually got speckle patterns off, you know, from the structural distortion. So that was the central peak phenomenon, which was generally traced to defects in the system that coalesced in the system. That's correct, yeah. So that's where that sort of central peak came from, the phonons.
There's been some discussion in the literature concerning small and large polarons are actually possible from small to large polarons. Do you have any indication from your measurements on large polarons in orbit?
Well, what would you call these? I mean, 10 angstroms, is that large or small?
Well,
that's kind of.
Small polaron usually would take a kind of one lattice space.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Everything
yeah.
else would be kind of a large polaron.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly don't have data like, you know, the europium selenide or something like that, where, you know, people have looked very carefully at putting one charge in and then seeing, you know, whether it's a 30 angstrom distortion or something like that. Our length scale in this regime, which is a heavily doped regime, is always of the order of 10 angstroms. All the length scales come out to this 10, 12 angstroms, right? Both for the structure and for the magnetic correlation range. You know.
Optical conductivity, for instance, measurements
in Oxford, in Lorentz,
and then some sonson,
Right. It's really hard to tell from the
It's hard to tell,
the
yeah.
The length scale you can't really extract, so you can extract the length scale for the correlations,
right.
Not the single polaron.
Right.
Just long-range electric distortion.
Right, yeah, so that's...
So there was some mention that the width might be related to the...
Not as Q equal to zero. the width of the peak is related to the relations, but not to the polarons, right?
Yeah.
Clarification. Question. So you have this picture where you have three peaks in two spin waves.
Right.
So if I take just a simple Heisenberg theorem, when close enough to this peak, in time I find a Q value, and I scan along the energy,
right,
I always see the central peak, it is diffusion peak. Just because you need
I knew I was going to get this question. Yeah, we've actually studied this in detail. So the statement is the following. I mean, at t equals zero, you have, you know, the ZZ part, which are Bragg peaks, and then the XY spin operators that are spin waves, okay? And then when you get up to TC in an isotropic magnet, you say X, Y, and Z are all equal. How'd you get there? Okay, and so this is kind of an interesting argument in the 70s and 80s that there should be ZZ fluctuations, and you see those in antiferromagnets. If you look at an antiferromagnet like rubidium manganese fluoride, an ideal isotropic Heisenberg antiferromagnet, you see a three-peak structure that rolls right through the phase transition, and it's rubidium manganese fluoride. But in all of the ferromagnets, iron and nickel, europium oxide, nobody saw that three-peak. And so to make a long story short, it's there, but you need to polarize neutrons. I actually have some data, but probably our chairman looks
getting far away from.
So that ZZ part of the scattering is there, but typically in ferromagnets, it's so strongly coupled to the XY part that it gets spread out in energy. And so what you see in an unpolarized neutron is just two peaks. And then the ZZ part, if you actually use polarized neutrons, is just a broad peak underneath. And so when you see this kind of relatively sharp central peak that hadn't been seen in isotropic ferromagnets before, and it has a different origin.
Yeah.
Sure.
Now it's time to speak.
Thank you very much.